From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Peter Medak is a filmmaker, but his own life reads like the script from a movie. As a boy growing up in Hungary, Medak fled from both the Nazis and the communists. Now he's best known for such films as The Ruling Class, The Craze, and the new film, Let Him Have It. Medak's movies and his life on this edition of Fresh Air. Also, humorous stories about a neurotic hypochondriac who tests positive for HIV. Writer David Feinberg insists he's not as neurotic as his fictional alter ego. Rock historian Ed Ward profiles the Isley Brothers. And Maureen Carrigan stretches out on her new recliner. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Former hostage Alan Steen has completed his medical checkups in Germany and will return home to the United States tomorrow, Deirdre Berger reports.
Alan Steen has been discharged from the medical center at Lindsay Air Force Base in Wiesbaden. Tomorrow, he heads home to Detroit with his family. That leaves just one former hostage in Wiesbaden, Terry Anderson. He is spending the evening at the hospital with family and a few close friends. Tomorrow, he will undergo further medical tests. At a press conference in Wiesbaden, Anderson joked that after trying to jog around the hospital grounds, he realized exercises during captivity had not kept him as fit as he thought. Anderson made an alert and concentrated impression during the press conference. He said as a Christian, he could not hate his captors, but he was not grateful to them either. Despite his nearly seven-year captivity, he praised the U.S. policy of non-negotiation with hostage takers. For National Public Radio, this is Deirdre Berger in Frankfurt.
Former American hostage Joseph Sisipio said today that he was repeatedly threatened during his captivity and that he often feared for his life. Sisipio addressed a welcoming crowd outside his brother's home in Norristown, Pennsylvania. The 61-year-old university administrator said his captors threatened to kill him in retaliation for Israel's kidnapping of the Shiite Muslim leader Sheikh Obeid. Sisipio said his death sentence was postponed twice and then frozen. He described himself as a changed man and said he was determined not to waste one moment of time. Congress named a special independent counsel today to investigate recent leaks in the U.S. Senate. His charge will be to look into alleged leaks relating to the nomination of Clarence Thomas and to the investigation of Charles Keating. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
In October, the Senate passed a resolution to appoint a special counsel to investigate the unauthorized disclosure of confidential information in both the Thomas nomination and the ethics investigation relating to Charles Keating. Today, Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell and Republican Leader Bob Dole named Peter Fleming Jr. to the post. In a joint statement, the leaders said that Fleming, who has served the Congress in the past as special counsel to the Select Committee on Crime, did not seek the position but was recommended highly. The appointment is effective January 1st. The resolution also provided that Fleming may use the Federal Bureau of Investigation and the General Accounting Office in his investigation. His findings will be reported to the Senate. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
Stock prices closed slightly lower today on Wall Street. Analysts said that the market was reacting to government reports that job losses in November were at their highest since last March, when the recession was thought to be at its worst. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost about 3 points to finish the day at 2,886.4. Advances edged declines. This is NPR News. The Federal Reserve added about $3 billion in reserves to the nation's banking system today, forcing down a key interest rate. Analysts said that the central bank's action should reduce the federal funds rate by a quarter point to 4.5%. Massachusetts Senator Edward Kennedy made a brief appearance on the witness stand this afternoon in the rape trial of his nephew, William Kennedy Smith. Doug Phillips reports from West Palm Beach, Florida.
Senator Kennedy entered the courtroom and waved slightly to his nephew seated at the defense table. It was Kennedy who got son Patrick and Smith out of bed to go to the night spot where his nephew met a woman. Kennedy was home when the woman was allegedly raped on the lawn, but told prosecutor Maura Lash nothing seemed unusual.
Did you hear anything at all that night at the Kennedy estate?
No, I did not.
Did you hear any screams?
No, I did not.
Did you hear any noises at all within the house itself?
No, I did not.
Kennedy's questioning by the prosecution and defense lasted less than an hour. Once he ignored the prosecutor's inquiry to say instead of going out on the night in question, he wishes he would have strolled on a beach instead. For National Public Radio, I'm Doug Phillips in West Palm Beach.
The White House denied today that there was any conflict of interest in President Bush's family ties to a Texas oil company that's won a contract to drill in the Persian Gulf. The president's eldest son, George Bush Jr., is a director of a small Texas company called Harkin Energy Corporation. Although it was in competition with several major companies, Harkin was chosen to look for oil off the coast of Bahrain. Today's edition of the Wall Street Journal detailed relations between Harkin officials, the White House, Saudi Arabia, and Bahrain. The paper stressed that its investigation found no evidence of wrongdoing or influence peddling by George Bush Jr. or anyone else connected with Harkin Energy. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Peter Medak is a director who has had the kind of life they make movies about. He grew up in Hungary, fled from the Nazis, and returned to face the repression of the communists. He was able to get out of Hungary in 1956 during a popular uprising which was quickly suppressed by Soviet tanks. Medak moved to England, where he got into the film industry and made such films as A Day in the Death of Joe Egg and The Ruling Class. In the 80s, he went to Hollywood and directed Zorro the Gay Blade and The Changeling. He returned to England for his last two films. The Craze was a complex character study based on the true story of Britain's most famous post-war gangsters. His new film, Let Him Have It, is also based on a true story in post-war England. In 1952, a 19-year-old reclusive, mentally handicapped man named Derek Bentley was talked into robbing a shop by 16-year-old Christopher Craig. When they were caught by the cops, Craig pulled out a gun and killed a policeman. Though Bentley didn't even have a gun, he was found guilty along with Craig. Craig was too young for the death penalty, but Bentley was given the death sentence and hanged. The British government recently reopened the case. I asked Peter Medak if this was due to his film.
Well, it's partly to do with the film. I mean, before the film opened in London, which was a couple of months ago, there was a screening at the House of Parliament for some members of the MPs and some of the kind of legal advisors and from the bar. And it had a tremendous impact on the audience, and a lot of them broke down and cried, and some of the wives had come, and a lot of them had forgotten or didn't know anything about it and realized that it was a ridiculous situation, and because everybody in England knew that that Derek was innocent. This movement started at that point at the Parliament, and about 150 MPs started petitioning and reached to the Home Secretary, who at that point ordered a reinvestigation of the case.
Where does it stand now?
Well, it really stands that nobody heard anything ever since. The police is investigating the police at the moment, and it could go two ways. On one hand, it could lead to nothing. On the other hand, it may just eventually lead to his posthumous pardon, which would be incredible because everybody knows that he didn't do anything.
You see the story of Derek Bentley and Chris Craig as being about two teenagers in post-war England who are posing as gangsters but who aren't really hardened criminals. Your previous film, The Craze, was about Britain's two top post-war gangsters. So you've made two related but different post-war crime films set in England. I'm wondering about the impact crime films have had on you as a watcher and as a filmmaker.
Well, very little, in fact, because unfortunately, I never see enough movies. I love films very much, but I never see enough pictures. You know, in America, film directors grow up totally on every frame of every movie because it's so much on television, it's being repeated. You know, I mean, they're all experts at it. I mean, I'm sure, I don't think there's a frame of an old movie which Spielberg hasn't seen or Marty Scorsese hasn't seen, you know, and I'm very envious of that, but I don't really have the time or the patience or the opportunity to do that. So I haven't grown up with that, and I've seen really very few of the, I mean, I love the Humphrey Bogart movies, and of course I have seen White Heat, But I'm not kind of obsessed or educated on all those frames of the old movies, so it didn't have an effect of it on me. However, it had something indirectly had an effect on me, is because when I was in Hungary and when I was a small child, I couldn't go to school because of my parent, my father, who was imprisoned by the Russians and this and that, and the usual story. And I used to hang out outside the American embassy and the British embassy because I had nothing to do all day long. And I pretended to be an American spy, you know. And I really, much more of those things get into the film indirectly.
So let me ask you, when you were posing as an American spy,
yes.
What would you do to get the right look?
I just had this raincoat, which my aunt sent from England. And I turned the collar up and I was just kind of hanging about looking at the photographs of Harry Truman opening up bridges. I mean, what they did in the American embassy in Hungary at the time, because it was really totally, I don't think people have the conception what it was like to be behind the Iron Curtain. And this is, I'm talking about 1948 to about 1955. You were totally closed off from the world. And the only way you could see what the West was like is if you dared to go in front of the embassy and look through the window. And they had like shop windows and a book turning with photographs of what was going on in America, about Marilyn Monroe and Harry Truman and Dwight Eisenhower and all that. And you just... they used to sell corn on the cob in the street corners here, the way they sell pretzels. And I was just chewing and I was saying, oh, well, I've got the upper hand because they don't know that I'm really working for the Americans. And I used to watch them, the American jeeps come from the airport and load and unload the empty bottles of the Coke with the full bottle of Coke going into the embassy because you couldn't buy Coca-Cola. But the image of the West for me was the Coke bottle, and I didn't really have it until I escaped out of Hungary. And it's a long story, but I mean, two of my friends, I left with three friends, and we wandered into this Austrian village, and both of my friends fell asleep in the stables, and I wandered down the village street, and there was this Coke machine at this gas station. So I rushed back and I woke both of my friends up and I said, guess what, there's this Coke machine, we can have our first Coke. And we staggered down the street and whatever little money we had, which we were given at the border when we got out, we put into this machine and nothing came out. And we were just standing there, these three little kids in the wind blowing in front of the image of the West, and it was broken.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, like so many of us have experienced not getting anything when you put in your quarter or your 50 cents or whatever now, but it never has had that kind of symbolic importance that it must have had to you.
Yeah, but and also, you know, watching it outside the embassy, always the empty bottles of Cokes coming out and the full crates going in and not be able to taste it.
Yeah, yeah. If you're just joining us, my guest is Peter Medak, and his new movie is Let Him Have It. He also directed The Craze and The Ruling Class. What was your father imprisoned for?
Well, tragically, we tried to escape in 1948, and we left on the wrong weekend, and we never got out. And the people who were going to smuggle us out of the country were caught a couple of weeks later, and all the names who were going to get out were spilled. And then... because of that, he was arrested. And once he was arrested, then they created a kind of a fake trial and they proved that he was an American spy, which he, of course, wasn't. And it's because of that I was supposedly a son of a capitalist. I wasn't fit to be educated, so I didn't go to school since I was 13.
You weren't permitted to go to school because of that?
No, which in a way I was very delighted about. But I mean, I was very envious of all my friends who went to college and universities, but I never had the chance to do that.
So you managed to escape from Hungary in, I think it was 1956?
56, yeah.
You went straight to England?
Yes, I did. I mean, first I went to Austria for a couple of weeks. And eventually, it was quite incredible because the entire world was so... openly welcoming all the refugees, and about 250,000 people got out in a matter of 2 weeks, and they all poured into Vienna. And all you had to basically do is go to an embassy of a country where you wanted to go register and be registered and examined, and eventually you got your passage and a ticket and money, and you could begin a life. So I always wanted to go to England, and that's where I went.
How did you start making movies? How did you start training for it?
Well, I fortunately, through my aunt, who was a very famous opera singer, who was incredibly well connected, I was introduced to an American gentleman who was, his name was C.J. Latta, and he ran Warner Brothers in England. And I went to see him, and he said, look, don't worry, you know, give me a couple of weeks and I'll find you some position. And he got me my first job as a trainee. And that's how I really started.
So here you were in this pretty awkward position. You didn't really know English very well. You hadn't grown up watching a lot of movies.
No.
Because there weren't a lot of movies in Hungary to be watched. And here you were trying to make movies. So you were pretty handicapped. It must have been hard to get started.
Well, the only thing is that I dreamt about making movies, though, since I was 8 years old. And it really came that this aunt of mine, the opera singer aunt, gave me a present for birthday of mine. It was for my 8th birthday or 10th birthday. I'm not quite sure which one, which was a 35mm hand crank projector and a piece of film. And I then started projecting this piece of film for everybody, days on end. And it really started my obsession. But I think what drove me to making movies was my loneliness in my own little life, of being isolated from my friends, of not being allowed to go to school. You know, so I had really spent my time dreaming. Looking out the window and seeing things in the sky and pretending, you know, this whole thing about pretending an American smile, pretending to be something you're not and play acting and trying to play out games.
If you'll let me make the connection to your new movie, To Let Him Have It, Derek Bentley, the teenager who was mentally handicapped and who did not pull the trigger but was found guilty anyways, he was epileptic, and he spent years and years in his room. And you depict him as somebody who is so tragically uncomfortable in the world. And I would guess you really relate to the way that you've depicted him in the movie.
Yeah, I do. I respond and I relate to tragedies, which doesn't mean that that's all I want to do, because there's nothing more I would love to do is an insane comedy, which is about life. But I think one's personal life, and I had so many terrible things happen in my early life. I mean, being a Jewish boy and going through the whole war and surviving that and watching life begin after a world war and then life beginning again, then the Russians coming in and this whole insanity about communism and the repression of it and not being allowed to go to school, then escaping out into the free world and starting a life on your own. And you know what I mean? I spent an awful lot of time on my own. And there's this desperate need there's tremendous emotions inside me. And I'm very emotional, and being Hungarian, rather melancholic and all that. But there's this desperate need to get that out. And when I come across stories like the Derek Bentley story, it just coincides with one's own life in a way, indirectly.
If you're just joining us, my guest is film director Peter Medak. His new movie is called Let Him Have It. He also directed The Craze and The Ruling Class. We're going to take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. You're just joining us. My guest is film director Peter Medak, and his films include the new movie Let Him Have It and The Craze. There was a period in your career early on when you worked in American television. I guess this must have been the late 50s or early 60s. Because I know you worked on such programs as Alfred Hitchcock Presents and The Virginian.
Yes.
I'm wondering what it was like for you as this Hungarian emigre who didn't grow up watching Westerns to suddenly be making one of these like TV genre series like The Virginian.
It was wonderful. I mean, what happened actually that I was an assistant director in England, and the last movie I worked on was a film called VIPs with Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton. And while I was on that film, I was offered this wonderful chance to sign a contract with Universal Studios, which was called then Review Productions, to come out for a few weeks to observe American television the way they're doing it, and then go back to England and work for them. And when I arrived at the studio, Sidney Sheinberg was a lawyer at the time, and I was his responsibility. And they discovered that they wanted someone English. And I was the one who turned up. And at that time, I was still stateless. I didn't have a British passport. And they expected someone with a ball hat and umbrella to turn up. And then here I came. And the project which they brought me out on fell through immediately. And I said to Sid, you know, well, I mean, before you send me back, I can't go back to England because everybody sent me off with this big farewell that the kid got his break. And I was in Hollywood after having come out of Hungary 7 years later. It was 1963. And I said, please, you know, I can't go back. And so just put me together with someone who can find out if I can direct or not. And then there was this period of time before they got my green card. Why I couldn't do anything else except observe. So I spent some time with Alfred Hitchcock, who was doing Marnie at the time. And that's when I first met Sean Connery. And then I spent time on Virginians and Wagon Train. I started to do second units and bits and pieces. And it was incredible because I was wandering under the back lot of the studio and had access to the library, and I could find in the same location silent movie day clips of what was shot in the studio. And it was just magical.
Your two recent movies, The Craze and Let Him Have It, are both in a way about people coming of age after the war in England. Now, you didn't live in England after the war. You were still living in Hungary. But can you just give me a little bit of a sense of what it was like for you right after the war? Because I would guess from these films that it had a big impact on you.
Yes, it was very well traumatic, but wonderful as well. Because you know, having escaped from Budapest in 1944, and then we hid next to the Gestapo in the country in a little village where the village changed hands between the Germans and the Russians three or four times. And we had to pretend to be Catholics. And my name was changed from Peter to something else. And I could never understand it. Why did I have to go to... And we weren't religious whatsoever. But why did I have to go to church every Sunday? And then when the war ended, of going back to Budapest... There's an incredible story. The day when we escaped out of Budapest in 1944, we were sitting down for lunch, my brother, me, and my mother and my father, and the maid was serving soup. And she went back to the kitchen, and she rushed in and said to my father that all the people from the opposite building are being taken away by the Hungarian SS. And my father rushed out, and he came back, and he said, "We got to leave right now." And we got up from the table with the four soup plates there, rushed down from this fourth floor, this wonderful kind of marble building, and got to the front door when a man was being chased by an SS guy and there was gunshots. And my father said, "Look, whatever you do, don't turn around." And we walked out to the street and walked past the dead body of this person who they just shot a second ago. And by some miracle, we got away before the SS surrounded our building and escaped out of Budapest. Then we hid, as I said, in the country for a year. And when the war was over, we came back to Budapest, and on a train, like all those pictures of the Russian revolutions where millions of people are on the top of the train. But my father put two wooden planks between the bumpers of two carts, and that's where we were sitting. And you could see the ground passing, and I still see it. And when we finally got back to the apartment in Budapest, we went up, and the wall was completely blown in, and you could see out into the kitchen, to the building where the Jews were taken away just before we escaped. And I was standing in the dining room with all the rubble on the floor. And to my amazement, there was the dining table with the four soup plates on it, with the dry soup still in it, a year later. And here, I was a little kid, just couldn't understand it, that all these terrible things happened in the world, and the world had turned upside down. And here I was in this room where time has stood still. And I hope one day I can really make a movie about it, which would use up all these images, because there are so many of them like that. But I will never forget those dried soup plates.
Wow, yeah. You know, I'm wondering, when you're meeting with people in Los Angeles about movies, if you ever think, you know, gosh, this is trivial. You know?
Yeah, I do.
The things that they want, and you know, the need for success and all of that. It just seems like you've been through a whole lot, and you want to make movies that have a lot of depth to it, and certainly is difficult to do that now.
It's very difficult. And I say to myself every day, I don't know what I'm doing there. And I am there, and we have a lovely house, and we live there, and all my kids live there, and that's why I'm there. And I really do believe that I can make, and I will be able to make, those kind of meaningful, sensitive films in America as well, because I really want to do my next movie in America, having done The Craze and Let Him Have It. And I think it is possible, but I don't think... I think I desperately need New Line, Miramax, you know, the independent companies who respond to the stories, you know, I want to make. You know, who you can't quite walk into Walt Disney Studios and tell them that story about the soup plates and saying, look, I really would love to make a movie about that, because they think I'm crazy. But it's not beyond the expectations that other independent sources would accept it, you know, because that's the answer. I mean, that's the kind of movies I would love to see. I mean, that's why when Louis Malle makes a movie in France, you know, we all flock to see it, because it touches you, because it talks about his life.
I really became familiar with your work through your last two movies. I mean, I'd seen The Ruling Class, but I saw that a long time ago. But I was so struck by your last two films, by The Craze and Let Him Have It. And I'm wondering if you think of yourself as being in a different part of your career artistically.
Yes. No, I think I am, because after Ruling Class, I've gone through a lot of personal problems. My first wife committed suicide, and it gave me a terrible shock, you know, and it takes many years to get over that, if one ever gets over it. And you lose your judgment, you get affected by other people or what film studios want and this and that, and you lose yourself. And I felt that I lost myself, really. And really, at the 11th hour, when it was nearly too late, I realized that I have to go back to my roots, which is in England, and go back to square one and do what I always been able to do, which were small, very intimate stories. And that was very important to me, and I feel that I lost myself, that I found myself completely and totally.
Well, I look forward to seeing your forthcoming films.
Good.
And I thank you so much for talking with us.
Okay, my pleasure.
My guest has been film director Peter Medak. His new movie is called Let Him Have It. And The Craze, by the way, if you'd like to see it, is out on video. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. B.J. Rosenthal is a Jewish, neurotic, gay man in his early 30s living in New York. He's a hypochondriac who's now HIV positive, but his life reads like a comedy. Coming up, we meet the writer who created B.J., David Feinberg. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles the Isley Brothers. And Maureen Carrigan settles back, puts her feet up, and tells us the tale of her new Lazy Boy recliner. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. At a sometimes emotional news conference this morning, Terry Anderson said after being held hostage in Lebanon for nearly 7 years, he wants some time to get used to the world again. Anderson said that when he was first captured, his kidnappers were pretty rough, but that ended fairly quickly. While he does not hate those who took him hostage, Anderson said that he believes they were very wrong.
There were things that I couldn't accept that they would do from time to time. I tried very much just to get along, like anybody does in that situation, just to get along from time to time, not to make too much trouble. But there were things that occasionally happened that I couldn't accept, that I would fight, I would argue about with them. Sometimes they would punish me for it. In the end, I think it helped to stop the things that I couldn't accept, let's put it that way. They seemed to have no enmity toward me. They even seemed to have small amount of respect, I hope, at the end.
Anderson told reporters in Wiesbaden, Germany, that a radio, mental exercises, and his faith helped him keep his sanity. A day after Soviet leader Gorbachev said that Moscow needed food aid, he called on leaders of four Soviet republics to send food to the capital. Because of concern over possible shortages for their own people, the various Soviet republics have been refusing to send their products to Moscow. There have also been severe transportation problems. The Soviet news agency TASS said that the Soviet president has warned that there are only a few days of supplies of meat, butter, and sugar, and now bread supplies are running out in Moscow. The State Department has announced that the U.S. will implement economic sanctions against Yugoslavia, ending certain trade benefits, assistance programs, and bilateral textile agreements. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
The U.S. sanctions will apply to all of Yugoslavia and not simply to Serbia and Montenegro, which are the greatest obstacles to a peaceful settlement, according to today's announcement. Sanctions could be targeted more narrowly against Serbia and Montenegro later, an administration official explained, but the first step was to end the existing trade and assistance agreements, which were negotiated with the central government of Yugoslavia when it represented all the republics and provinces. Now that the existing agreements with the central government have been terminated, the official explained, the U.S. can restore trade and economic ties with some republics and not with others, not with Serbia and Montenegro, for example, thereby punishing only the aggressors in this fight. Also, restoring economic ties with individual republics would be a first step toward U.S. recognition of the independence of those republics, but the Bush administration does not want to grant that recognition now. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down nearly 3 points to close at 2,886.40 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. The government says that the nation's unemployment figure stayed at 6.8% last month. However, at the same time, nearly 241,000 jobs were lost. The job loss was the largest since spring, and officials said one reason was updated seasonal adjustments. However, without that adjustment, payrolls would have still been down some 170,000 jobs. According to a new report released today in Washington, U.S. colleges, public schools, and research facilities are selling American brain power and breakthrough technologies to the highest bidder, generally the Japanese. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
According to the privately funded Center for Public Integrity, since 1981, the Japanese government and business giants like Toyota and Hitachi have invested $4.5 billion in educational materials for public schools and scientific research at top colleges and universities. Harvard University, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and the University of California, Irvine alone have received $135 million from the Japanese in the past 5 years. Almost all of it for high-tech research with significant commercial and military potential. The authors of the report say they want to create a national commission to look into it because they're afraid the Japanese are hiring away American scientists and influencing public policy research. College officials today said Japanese investors were not unduly influencing U.S. researchers, and they're not about to give up the money they've gotten. American labor unions, corporations, and private foundations help pay for the report. I'm Claudia Sanchez in Washington.
Alan Greenspan says that the nation's economic recovery is showing signs of slowing down. The chairman of the Federal Reserve told a business group in Florida that business and consumers are showing an unusual degree of caution, along with doubts about the future. Less than 2 months ago, Greenspan said that the economy had turned sluggish. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Even now, in the 1990s, most of America has a hard time dealing with the concept of a black rock band. Just ask the band Living Color. Rock historian Ed Ward says while it would be an exaggeration to say that all rock and roll came from black music, there's no doubt that black contributions to rock and roll, not soul music or dance music or the blues, but rock and roll, have been underplayed. That's why Ed says it's subversive to listen to the Isley Brothers these days.
Well, you know you make me wanna shout, kick my heels up and shout, throw my hands up and shout, throw my head back and shout, come on now, don't forget to say you will, don't forget to say
One day in 1956, Ronald, Rudolph, and O'Kelly Isley, three gospel-singing brothers in their teens, left their hometown of Cincinnati on a bus for New York and, they hoped, stardom. They worked hard for 3 years, making lots of bad records and playing gigs. At one show at Washington's Howard Theater, they improvised a coda on their version of Jackie Wilson's Lonely Teardrops, and that's how their first hit, Shout, was born. Shout wasn't a huge smash. It only got to number 47 on the pop charts and never dented the black charts. But it was a very influential record. Still, that doesn't pay the bills, and RCA, the label that had released Shout, let the boys go. It wasn't for three more years, in 1962, that they'd really see success.
Shake it up, baby.
Twist and Shout was one of the hottest records of the summer, so hot that the Beatles tacked it on to the end of their first album recording session 6 months later. But even so, the Isleys couldn't seem to score a follow-up, even though they were making good records like Nobody But Me. Still, they were determined, so they did two things. First, they formed their own record label, T-Neck, so they'd have some place to put out their stuff. Second, they got a band together and toured, recording when they could.
Brothers and sisters, it's a wildest song making, sir. If you want to have some soul, if you want to be a witness, I want you to listen while I testify. Maybe I can help you to get some soul and be a witness, baby. You want to be a witness? All it takes is the rhythm in your feet. Don't.
Their show is noted for its hard-rocking gospel frenzy and its weird guitarist, Jimmy James, who played on that track, Testify, and is better known as Jimi Hendrix. By 1966, they must have been discouraged because they were at Motown making good records but not sounding much like themselves. And, as well as This Old Heart of Mine did, Motown let them go after a while. The Isleys knew it was time for a change, so they went back home and hired three of the younger members of their family, brothers Ernie and Marvin, and their cousin, Chris Jasper. This turned the Isley brothers into something rare for black music in the early 70s, a self-contained band.
It's your thing, do what you wanna do.
That self-contained band had a secret weapon that was also almost unheard of among black audiences in those days. They had a lead guitarist, Ernie Isley, who'd learned a lot from the band's ex-guitarist. They'd recorded That Lady before as a Latin-flavored thing nearly 10 years earlier, but what made it a smash this time was the rock and roll flavor. The Isleys kept going as a sextet until 1983, continuing to smash boundaries, recording Crosby, Stills and Nash and Seals and Crofts songs and having soul hits with them and bringing that guitar right out front. The band eventually split along generational lines, and O'Kelly Isley died in 1986. But in 1990, Ernie Isley released a stunning black rock album, Live Wire. Just to prove that things haven't changed, it flopped.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll, and he writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air. Being a neurotic hypochondriac was hard enough. Life became a lot more complicated when BJ tested HIV positive. BJ's idea of a perfect mate was a well-built doctor. Now he had more doctors to get crushes on. BJ is the creation of my guest, David Feinberg, who has written for The Advocate, Outweek, and Diseased Pariah News. In Feinberg's first novel, 86th, BJ went from the world of gay bars and cruising to the beginning of the AIDS era. Spontaneous Combustion is a new collection of stories that follow BJ, his friends and lovers, from 1985 to 1990. Here's a reading.
In 1987, I was bad news for those of gainful employ. My optometrist lost her job. My financial consultant at Citibank was replaced by a computer. Even my regular checkout lady at the AMP was dumped from the payroll. That year, if you wanted a career change, all you had to do was conduct business with me. So, let me give you the full picture. My boss was on the way out. My social life was a shambles. I hadn't had a date since the early Mesozoic era or the discovery of personal grooming, whichever came first. The paint on the walls of my apartment was peeling. My glasses were being repaired back at the Coke bottle factory. My 3-day shaving lapse looked less Italian fashion model chic than Iranian terrorist. I had a loose filling. My phone was on the blink. The fridge needed defrosting. My gym membership had expired. I'd run out of stiff stuff for my hair and was reduced to using Vaseline. I was a 30-year-old male homosexual living at the center of the worst epidemic of the century, and I still bit my nails and picked my nose on the sly, and I had yet to decide what I was going to do with my life if I grew up. In short, things were a mess. And on top of this was the matter of Gordon. My best friend, Gordon, was ill. In 1987, it was unnecessary to specify of what. It had only taken Gordon 3 months to tell me his diagnosis. He called me the week before Christmas to inform me that he had just been fired from his multinational conglomerate and that he was about to file an AIDS discrimination suit against them. A rather roundabout way of telling me the worst news in the world. But then Gordon was never known for his straightforwardness. Later, Gordon asked me if I could keep it under my hat for a while. You know, it's sort of like coming out again, he said. I guess you have to do it in stages.
And that's David Feinberg reading from his new book, Spontaneous Combustion. You managed to find the humor in your subject matter. and I wonder if it's that easy to find the humorous side of things when it's your life and your friends as opposed to your fiction that you're writing. In other words, does your sense of humor work for you in life as well as it does in fiction?
Yeah, pretty much so. You know, it's a defense mechanism. You know, it's a way of lessening the horror of, you know, the tragedy that's going on, you know, that's been going on for the past 10 years. Yeah, you make jokes about things, you know, to sort of appropriate them, to sort of get some control over them. So, yeah, we make jokes all the time.
You tested for the HIV virus in 1987. Did the experience of finding out that you tested positive change you as a writer? How much had you been writing before that?
I think I actually tested. I had finished 86, and I just gave the manuscript to a publisher, you know, Viking, thinking no chance in hell they'd take it. And so then, you know, the next day I got tested, you know, and I was waiting. I'm probably writing about the same, you know. There's an air of urgency. You know, I have an informal goal of finishing 5 books, and you know, I'm on book number 3 now, so.
Why did you time it to get tested the day after you handed in the manuscript? Was this intentional timing?
Getting tested was something, you know, that I, you know, mulled over for a couple years. I think it was probably available in 85, 86. You know, so it took a while to get to that point. And, well, no, I mean, it's just like, okay, you know, I do things in an order, you know, like I do this thing and then that thing. It's, okay, finish the book. Okay, get tested. Okay, you do a will, you know. That was the last big thing I did. It was sort of like a 6-month process of getting a will done. You know, I had a bad side effect. I'd made an appointment with a lawyer and I had to cancel it because I had bad side effect from one drug that I was taking. So, you know, I rescheduled it 4 months later. It took a while.
Right.
After that, I got cable TV, you know. Orderly process, you know, like my little checklist, you know, so make will, get cable.
Your character BJ, when he tells his mother that he's tested positive for HIV, she doesn't handle it very well. And
I'm sure she's shocked. Yeah.
What was your experience like telling your mother?
Much more positive than this, of course. But basically, I take incidents from my life and I exaggerate them. I stretch them out as far as I can go, you know. So it's still believable, you know, but I just want to say, okay, what would be the worst possible thing to happen? And that's what I do. You know, my mom's been very supportive. It took a while. I mean, initially there was a shock, you know, but after a month or so, you know, like she's supportive.
Well, as your character said, it's like coming out. You have to do it in stages, you know, telling people that you test positive. So when did you decide to tell her?
This is really funny. I'd written a piece for the Village Voice about taking AZT, and the editor told me that it'll be in next week. So I said, oh, better tell Mom. Not that she reads the Village Voice, you know, but, like, I mean, someone's going to read it, and someone's going to call her, and they're going to blah, 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 blah. So I told Mom, and the piece never ran.
So she might not have known yet if it wasn't for that piece.
Oh, yeah, well, she probably would have. You know, it was hanging over me, you know. I guess, you know, after 6 months, you know, I said, okay, well, I better tell. I think I decided to tell her as soon as I started taking AZT or something like that. You know, if I was just HIV, I'm still asymptomatic. I'm just taking, you know, drugs. But I decided that would be the point that I would tell her, and I'd been taking it for a while.
Your first novel, 86, opens in 1980 before AIDS. How old were you then?
1980, let's see, 24.
So you came of age just before AIDS started to spread?
Yeah. I guess I came out when I was around 20. I was living in L.A., you know, it was a little easier to come out with, I guess, 3,000 miles between me and my, you know, where I grew up.
What was life like for you in the early 80s before then, when you came out?
Well, I mean, it was fun. Everybody wasn't dying. I wasn't, you know, really, you know, going to bars and going to clubs or anything like that, you know, but, you know, it was fun. You'd meet people and have a good time.
Since you test HIV positive, do you ever really get attracted to someone who tests negative and it gets really complicated about, you know what I mean, how you're going to tell him and what his reaction is going to be to that? And
Oh, yeah. I mean, I just try to, you know, mention it as early as possible. You know, just in some casual thing. Oh, by the way, I've been an ACT UP since I tested positive a couple of years ago. You know, just sort of try to slip that in, you know, like, or just mention, oh, what drugs are you on? I'm taking AZT. Oh, you're negative? Oh, well, that's nice. You know, you just sort of slip it in very early.
Well, David Feinberg, thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you very much.
David Feinberg's new book, Spontaneous Combustion, is published by Viking. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. We'll have tonight hearings on Capitol Hill about the nation's economy. Also, Senator Edward Kennedy testifying at his nephew's rape trial in West Palm Beach, Florida. Freed hostage Terry Anderson tells stories about his time in captivity in Lebanon. And NPR's Ann Garrels reports on speculation about retaliation in the Middle East, the possibility of action being taken against those who held the hostages. Ina Jaffe has a story from Hawaii about Japanese Americans there and about their status both before and after the war. Also, letters from Americans from more than 50 years ago, servicemen aboard the Arizona stationed at Pearl Harbor.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. It's been hard to get commentator Maureen Carrigan into the studio this week. She didn't want to leave her living room. Here's why.
My best friend, Mary Ellen, and I grew up together in Queens, New York. I used to love to go over and play at her family's apartment. It was cavernous, and the refrigerator was always stocked with Schraff's coffee ice cream. But best of all, Mary Ellen's parents would hardly ever come into her bedroom to yell at us, no matter how much noise we made. They couldn't intrude because they couldn't move. They were trapped, marooned really, in twin beige Lazy Boy recliners positioned on either side of the living room sofa and facing, what else, the television set. It's impossible to imagine Mary Ellen's parents back then jogging or doing any of the other things that adults do these days to stay fit. Instead, they sunk with dignity into sedentary middle age, just like they sunk every evening into their matching Lazy Boys. Mary Ellen's mother and then her father died a few years ago. I went to visit her after her father's death, and when I walked into her living room, there were the two lazy boys. That may have been the first time I actually sat in one. It tilted back slowly and scooped me up into its plump, plushy arms. Right away, I felt drowsy, and I had a strong hankering for a highball and the Reader's Digest, the things Mary Ellen's parents usually kept within easy reach. I knew then that I wanted a lazy boy, but I tried to fight the urge. Furniture with handles is so unhip. Plus, I didn't like the political implications of a recliner. My living room, with its VCR and cable TV, is already enough of a retreat. If I bought a lazy boy, I'd be totally capitulating to the privatization of everyday life that accompanies the mating and the aging processes. Still, personal desire can't always be quelled by political conviction. I found myself sneaking into furniture stores, checking out lazy boys, barca-loungers, strata-loungers, what the industry ironically calls motion furniture. One store even sold kitty cliners with miniature handles and footrests. Put your kids into one of these, and they instantly turn into George Burns. Finally, this past weekend, I bid goodbye to youth. It didn't take much to convince my husband, a born comfort craver, to come with me to a lazy boy showcase shoppy. We looked at French Provincial, Art Deco, and early American models. We tested out twin cliners. Those are two lazy boys soldered together, and something called the Electralift Power Recliner, a lazy boy with a motor for comatose couch potatoes. We decided on a blue chaise rocker recliner, an overstuffed chair with full body support. When we got our lazy boy home, we flipped a coin to see who would use it first. I won. In memory of Mary Ellen's parents, I popped open a beer, the closest thing I had to a highball. In my other paw, I held the remote channel changer. Exercise class started in an hour, but who could be bothered? I rocked back, the footrest eased into place, and I began to doze. When I woke up later that rainy afternoon, my husband asked, "So how was it?" I looked up at him and whimpered, "I've fallen and I can't get up."
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and is performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Donald Fagen grew up listening to jazz, but he landed on the rock charts as the co-leader of the band Steely Dan. On the next Fresh Air, Fagen talks with us about growing up, the Steely Dan years, and his new record featuring his New York Rock and Soul Review. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.